Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm your host, Cynthia Pooler. And my guest today is former gubernatorial candidate Howie Hawkins. And Howie Hawkins is going to talk about two issues. One, the Electoral College, and what's going on with Jill Stein. So, Howie, let's get to the Electoral College first. You are an elector. Can you tell everybody listening how you became an elector and what your responsibilities are?
Sure. In the case of the Green Party, it was the state convention of the Green Party that elected its electors for the nominee of the Green Party, which was going to be later in the year. So in our case, it was the party. In the case of most state parties, in the Democratic and Republican parties, it's the candidate who gets the nomination who picks the electors committed to them. So that's the general process. So that happened in the Green Party in May, and our convention to nominate Jill Stein was in August.
Uh-huh.
So if she had won New York, I would have gone to a meeting in Albany to cast an electoral vote, and I was pledged to Jill Stein, and I would have cast it for her, but she didn't win New York,
uh-huh.
So I won't be going anywhere when the Electoral College meets.
So what's the difference between an elector and a delegate to the National Convention if the candidate picks both of them?
Well, in the Green Party, it's the party membership and the delegates to the convention that pick both delegates to the national convention and electors for our presidential ticket.
Mm-hmm.
In the Democrat and Republican parties, I don't know the details, but their convention delegates to the national conventions are picked by the state party by various mechanisms. So usually the party co-chairs and the state executive committee has a lot of say in who the delegates are. Sometimes they allocate them. In fact, they have primaries. Actually, yeah, they have primaries. And if you look on the ballot for the general election, we didn't have a Green Party primary, so I didn't see that there, but I imagine it's the same. It says electors for Jill Stein or electors for Hillary Clinton or electors for Donald Trump or all the candidates for Bernie Sanders. So The electors, you know, the candidate has a slate of electors that the candidate has chosen. And then when you vote for the electors for that candidate, people think they're voting for the candidate, but they're actually voting for the electors. And the same thing in the primary. There it's delegates committed to the candidate. So
right.
It's primary elections in the major parties that elected their national convention delegates, except for the superdelegates who, you know, were chosen by, you know, from the top down in the Democratic Party side. And in the Green Party, it was our state convention that elected both national delegates and our electors for the nominee.
So going back to November 8th, when I went to a polling place to vote, I didn't see any electors on the ballot. Did I miss something?
Yeah, in small print above, say you voted for Jill Stein, it said electors for Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka.
Oh, okay.
So if you look
and
down
the
presidential
thing,
column, it all had electors for in front of all the candidates.
Okay, and that's the way it's always done on the ballot then, right?
Yeah. In some states,
okay,
they may list all the electors, but that takes up a lot of room. And our machines historically and our electronic ballots now that are scanned, there's not room for that.
So, you know, people vote, but then they know that the electors are going to have the final say. And my guess is a lot of people don't really look that close at the ballot to understand that the electors are on the ballot also. So it's interesting, you know, having to be able to speak to you about how the process works. So, you know, in New York State, Hillary won New York. She won California. And how did Jill do in New York?
100,000 votes for about 1%, 1.4%.
So ultimately, was 1.4 the overall average, or did it go higher?
It was lower nationwide. It was around 1%.
It was 1%. Okay, now, in the news the past couple of days, Jill Stein, you know, has made, you know, she's made a lot of the news, and she's talking about recounts in Pennsylvania and I believe two other states. What is her rationale, and do you think that a recount can change the outcome of the election?
I doubt the recount will change the outcome, but there are a lot of anomalies and questions that this enables researchers who are concerned with election integrity to find out. The Greens did this in 2004 in Ohio, and it led to the conviction of two Cuyahoga County election officials, with the judge believing they were acting under higher-up orders, where the GOP tried to rig the recount that the Greens and the Libertarians had together triggered. It also led to a lot of states taking a second look at DRE election machines, that's direct electronic recording, where there's no paper trail. And in fact, after that, California got rid of those machines. So all their ballot machines have a paper trail that can be audited in a recount.
Uh-huh.
So that's the kind of outcome we're looking for here. It's about election integrity. And, you know, the hacking thing is big. You know, did the Russians hack? Did some GOP firm that, you know, provided the machines set up the software? I think there's a slight chance of that affecting the outcome. But if these machines are not calibrated correctly, for example, the ones we use in New York where you have a ballot scanned, if the calibration is off by a very small amount, votes may not be counted. And if it's, it could bias if it happens consistently in one machine or in several machines. And then there are provisional ballots, which often don't get counted when the result is not within a very narrow threshold. So we want to have a second look at the provisional ballots. And one of the reasons this is triggered is that the exit polls in those three states showed Clinton winning handily, and the actual results showed Trump winning narrowly. So why that disparity? You know, when the U.S. monitors elections, you know, like the Carter Institute or so forth, in other countries, they use exit polling as a way to, as a check on what the actual tally is. And because there's a discrepancy here, it raises flags. And so we want to have a recount so we can see exactly what happened. And if there was a problem, get it corrected.
You know, because a lot of people are pointing their fingers at Jill Stein and saying that she's only doing this to help Clinton. And somebody told me today, why is Jill Stein doing this? She's ruining her reputation, and she's destroying the Green Party. So there's all kinds of innuendos that are out there. So from the innuendos that you have heard, can you dispel them?
Yeah, I think the concern from people that are saying, you know, Jill Stein's working with the Democrats is that we raised about $3.5 million for the whole campaign. And then in 2 or 3 days, we raised double that for this election recount. And organizations like MoveOn.org, which is pro-Democratic Party, anti-Green Party, told its members to contribute to the recount. They did it for their own reasons. They want to change the election result. And there, you know, a lot of Democrats. Now, most of the contributions, all the contributions had to be less than the federal limit of $2,700. The average contribution was $45. So it was thousands and thousands of small contributions that raised this money from, you know, these people may indeed hope that it will result in Clinton getting elected. But the Green purpose, Jill Stein's purpose, was election integrity. Let's make sure the vote was correctly counted. There weren't any problems with provisional ballots or the mechanics of the voting machines, so that in the future we can have trust in our voting system. Now, because a lot of, you know, grassroots Democrats are supporting this recount, some people are saying, oh, you know, we're cozying up to the Democratic Party. But I think they're worrying about a problem that's not there.
There's been all kinds of hand-wringing amongst the Democrats now. And, you know, all throughout the campaign, the Democratic-leaning news outlets were saying the Republican Party is in its death throes. There's going to be no more Republican Party as we know it. Well, come to find out, it's the Democrats that are, you know, in bad shape. So from your perspective, can you kind of tell people what your thoughts are, the two major parties, what happened in this election, and how the Greens are going to go on from this point?
Well, as far as both parties concerned, I think they both have problems with their working class and lower middle class voting bases. It's those voting bases that supported Sanders on the Democratic side and Trump on the Republican side. And those bases have had it with the corporate elites that run both parties. The problem with the Trump vote was that he's really part of the corporate elite, and it's showing now. He represents the extreme right wing of the capitalist class. And, you know, you look at the appointments, they're for privatization, holy war in the Middle East. That's what General Flynn's about, despite all the non-interventionist hints that Trump gave. And repression, the guy that they want to head the CIA believes in torture. So this is the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, and that's where the elites are very comfortably getting behind the Trump agenda, which involves privatization of Medicare, voucherization of public education, infrastructure through tax credits for private investors rather than public investment. So that's where that is. And the average Trump voter that thought he'd bring back jobs and create jobs through public investment and leave Social Security and Medicare alone is going to be really surprised and, I think, angry. On the Democratic side, I think the elites are still in charge. That's why Clinton was able to get the nomination. The people that voted for Sanders for change lined up behind Clinton as the lesser evil for the most part, and they still lost. And so those people are still there, and they're not going to be happy with the direction of the Democratic Party. I think what people on the left need to watch out for is what the corporate Democrats always do, and that is they put progressive personalities out there, Elizabeth Warren, Keith Ellison, Bernie Sanders, and so forth, in front of the party to lure progressives back into the Democratic Party, which the corporate interests are still in charge of. I mean, Chuck Schumer is going to be the highest elected official in the Democratic Party, and he's very much a corporate neoliberal, you know, led in, when he was in the House, you know, the deregulation of Wall Street in the House side, you know, that Clinton got done. And, you know, it's not for really for the people in terms of those things. You know, where the fight between the Democrats and Republicans will happen is, what do we do with our social insurance programs, particularly Medicare and Medicaid? And that will be a fight. But you got to remember, the Democrats under Clinton were trying to partially privatize Social Security before Clinton was impeached, and Chuck Schumer was in favor of that. So I think the bases of both parties are going to be upset. They're still angry, and that's the Green Party's opportunity. You know, we've got to have a message, and more than that, our weakness is not our message, it's our organization. We got to have the grassroots organization. We need people as dues-paying members so we have the resources to actually organize, begin electing people to local office, and from there, credible candidates for state and office in the House of Representatives. And once we get people there, then when we run a presidential campaign, we won't be considered on the margins, but part of the debate, because we do have people in the state legislatures and the U.S. Congress.
Now, let me ask you this, and it's an issue I bring up time after time, and I'm very concerned about it, and that's the student loan debt crisis. And Jill mentioned it during the campaign. She mentioned it over and over and over again. And the people who owe a lot of money because of the student loans. They didn't listen. They didn't hear. How come Jill didn't get more than 1% with so many people indebted in this country?
I think more didn't hear about it than didn't listen. And that's a big crisis going forward, and it's only getting worse. Now, the problem is young people didn't vote very much. Fired by the two major party candidates, they stayed home compared to the older folks. I was just looking at some statistics for Syracuse. The average voter in the last, I don't know about this presidential election, but in the last local election was 61 years old, and the median age in the city of Syracuse is in the 20s. And we had, turnout in the teens. So young people aren't voting. That's the bigger problem. And working class people aren't voting. In this election, 42% of eligible voters didn't vote in the presidential election. That's the future base of the Green Party. Those people are disproportionately working class. They're totally disgusted and alienated from the system. And if we have the organization to reach them with our message, I think we can get them back involved and have a giant voting base to make some changes.
Now, from your perspective, you have been involved with the Green Party for a long time, and you had organized in 2016. What do you see for 2018 and 2020 that could boost the popularity of the Green Party?
I see 2017. That's local elections in New York and in many other states. And that's where the Greens can be competitive, because it doesn't take a lot of money to knock on all the doors in your council district and make yourself known and your message known. And we have elected people at that level. We need to elect thousands more. And that creates a foundation for electing more people. We've elected a few to state legislatures, but electing a good cohort of Green Party legislators at the state level and at the congressional level. So if we run strong campaigns in 2017 and elect people locally, then in some of the congressional districts we can run credible candidates. And, I don't know if we can win any yet, but, half the battle is getting in the debate. And if you have elected officials in the district who are of the Green Party, then the voters and the media will take Green candidates for state legislature and Congress seriously. So that's 2018. And conceivably, by 2020, we could have some members of Congress and be a much stronger party in the national scene. The Republican Party grew from founding in 1854 to the second largest party in Congress in 1856, to the largest caucus. It was a plurality, if I'm remembering correctly, in 1858. So they were really the first party, or maybe they were the second party at that point, but by 1860 they were the first party. So it can happen quickly if there's, a major issue. And the growing economic hardship and increasing inequality has been a big issue in 2016. The Sanders and Trump campaigns kind of give evidence for that. And we're getting the Trump presidency, or even if it flips to Clinton after the recount, she doesn't have a program to reduce inequality. So that issue will remain, and the Greens will remain relevant on that ground alone, let alone the climate crisis and many other major issues. So that's the way I look at it. I look forward to 2018 and 2020 by saying we got to do stuff in 2017 at the local level to prepare for those elections.
Well, Howie, thank you so much. This is a conversation that definitely will be continued. You've been listening to Howie Hawkins, former gubernatorial Green Party candidate. If you like the show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, and if you have a comment or criticism about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter and share your thoughts. Howie, thank you so much for being so patient this evening and taking the time to talk. We'll talk again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good night.
All right. Good night.
Thank you.